And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Hello, this is Martin Willis, your host. And we're not actually coming at you live. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more later. First of all, I've gotten a bunch of emails over the last year or so, people wondering what the clips were in the intro that I have on this, where they came from. So I'm going to talk about them real quickly. This is a little trivia here. The first one is Chase Klitsky, and she's talking about a large triangle flying over her when she was doing an investigation for MUFON. The second one is Seth Shostak from SETI. He's the senior astronomer there. And I debated him on UFOs, and that was part of his debate. These are all from past shows, of course. And the third one is Chase Klitsky again. The fourth one is Klaus Svahn. He's director of UFO Sweden. And he was talking about a case about a flying saucer in the middle of a clearing. And last but not least is Ben Hansen. And he's talking about his grandfather, who was involved in some secret part of the military, couldn't talk to his family about it. And at the very end of his life, he actually, on his deathbed, told his son, which is Ben's father, that we are not alone. Very compelling. So that's it for the intro. So first of all, I'm going to tell you what this show is not. This show is not live, and this show is not with Whitley Strieber. There was some technical difficulties last night with the show, and Michael and Whitley just could not get through to the producer. So that show hopefully will happen again. I am reaching out to Whitley. He's hard to get on a show these days. Another thing this show is not is a full hour. It's a short interview today. We do have a clip from Andy Fleming coming up on Supernovas, and after that, we have an interview with Nomar Slevic on his book titled UFOs Over Maine, Close Encounters of the Pine Tree State. A little bit of housekeeping. Our website did go down for a number of days. We had to get a dedicated server. Some people have actually helped out. I really appreciate that. Most of you know that I really do not like talking about the money part of the show. But if you can help out, we have a PayPal button. You can subscribe for a monthly fee, or you can help us out with a one-time donation. Yes, the story of success and of a lot of traffic and using a lot of bandwidth is Podcast UFO is now in the red. So any help out that you can do is greatly appreciated. If you can help us out, we totally understand that, and we still appreciate each and every listener. So right now, get ready. It's Andy Fleming on Supernovas.
And hello, Martin and listeners. Now, one of the astronomical objects that will be visible in earthly skies at some point in the future will be a supernova. Now, it's a stellar explosion that is extremely luminous, and it causes a burst of radiation that often briefly outshines an entire galaxy before fading from view over several weeks or months. During this short interval, a supernova can radiate as much energy as the Sun is expected to emit over its entire lifespan. Several large stars within the Milky Way have been suggested as possible supernovae within the next million or few years. These include Eta Carinae, VY Canis Majoris, Betelgeuse, Antares, and Speaker. The explosion expels much or all of a star's material at a velocity of up to 30,000 kilometers per second. That's 10% of the speed of light. This drives a shockwave into the surrounding interstellar medium. This shockwave sweeps up an expanding shell of gas and dust called a supernova remnant. Now, the word nova means new in Latin, referring to what appears to be a very bright new star shining in the heavens. The prefix super distinguishes supernovae from ordinary novae, which also involve a star increasing in brightness, though to a lesser extent and through a slightly different mechanism. The word supernova was coined by Swiss astrophysicist and astronomer Fritz Zwicky in 1926. Now, several types of supernovae exist. A type 2, or core collapse supernova, can be triggered by either turning off or suddenly turning on the production of energy through nuclear fusion. After the core of an aging massive star ceases generating energy from nuclear fusion, it may undergo sudden gravitational collapse and explode, creating a neutron star or a black hole, releasing gravitational potential energy that heats up and expels the star's outer layers. Alternatively, a white dwarf star may accumulate sufficient material from a stellar companion, either through accretion or via a merger, to raise its core temperature enough to ignite carbon fusion, at which point it detonates at this so-called Chandrasekhar limit, which is roughly 1.4 times the mass of our Sun. Now, this is a Type 1a supernova and will one day be the fate of the white dwarf star Sirius B, or the pup. It is currently accreting material from Sirius A, which at only 8.6 light years away is the brightest star in our nighttime sky. Now, although no supernova has been observed in the Milky Way since 1604, supernovae remnants indicate, on average, the event occurs about once every 50 years, and they play a significant role in enriching the interstellar medium with higher mass elements. One such supernovae was observed by Chinese astronomers way back in 1054 AD. And today, with dark skies and a telescope, it can be seen as the Crab Nebula, a supernova remnant otherwise known as Messier Object 1, NGC 1952, or simply Taurus A. At its centre lies a rapidly rotating neutron star, a supernova remnant, called, of course, a pulsar. Now, the expanding shock waves from supernova explosions can trigger the formation of new stars, thus lighting up the future cosmos.
As always, thank you so much, Andy. And coming up right now, we have Nomar Slevic on UFOs in Maine.
I loved your book. I grew up in Maine myself. And the name of the book is UFOs Over Maine, Close Encounters from the Pine Tree State. And I'm glad you wrote this book. I want to, first of all, talk about how you got interested in the subject. And you had something happen at an early age, right?
I did, yeah. I was living in Fort Kent at the time, which, as you probably know, it's a stone's throw away from Canada. And my bedroom window faced the St. John River. And I woke up in the middle of the night to a loud bang. And then I heard and saw some rain. And then I saw some really strange lightning. And the lightning kind of appeared much longer than you know, what I could understand. And I drifted back off to sleep eventually. And when I woke up in the morning, the lightning was still there. It was very confusing to me. I was, you know, probably 4 or 5 years. And I went to show my father that the lightning was still in the clouds. And once we looked outside, it wasn't there anymore, and it made me think that was maybe the first time, you know, I had a UFO encounter.
Huh. And but there was some other times as well. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. As I got older, I saw some, you know, some other things that seemed odd in the night sky. When I was living in Freeport, Maine, this was back in, you know, 2006, 7, and 2005 or so, I saw two white lights and a red light in the middle hovering above the house that lived, that was across the street from me. And, of course, I thought that was odd. And my roommate actually spotted it first. Mm-hmm. And I went outside and took a look at it. And it was probably, you know, 100, 200 feet over over the house, and I sat there and watched it for a little bit, tried to take a picture with my cell phone, which was vastly inferior at the time. And so I only got a little red streak there. And then it moved up a little bit. You know, it was stationary and then moved up, you know, at an angle very slowly, maybe another 20, 30, 40 feet, tough to, you know, gauge. And then after, you know, a few minutes or so, it started moving at a level trajectory towards the town of Brunswick. So that's when I got in my car and started to follow it and almost immediately lost sight of it and, you know, never saw it again.
Now, what inspired you to actually write the book? And we're going to talk about that in particular because I really enjoyed reading some of these cases. Some of them I knew about, some I never heard about. But what made you start to write the book?
Well, I guess that goes all the way back to that first encounter I had as a child. I've been interested in all things paranormal as a child, and that stayed with me through my teenage years and through my, you know, my 20s. And now, you know, I'm getting close to 40, and it's still a passion and a fascination. And but why I wrote this book in particular is I have a pretty big library of main books on the paranormal. And there's one in particular that's great, The Supernatural Side of Maine by C.J. Stevens. Great book. But again, you know, so I have a huge library of main books on the paranormal, and there was not one book, still not, you know, besides this one, that dealt with solely UFOs. There were stories with UFOs in them, but not a book dedicated to it. And I really wanted to take on the challenge of trying to present a book solely dedicated to it.
And how long did that take you to do the research on this?
Oh, I'd say about 2.5-3 years.
And let's talk about some of the cases. Of course, you and I have been talking on Facebook for, I don't know, perhaps 6 months or so. And
sure.
So I'm sure you probably listened to the Allagash show that I did.
Which is great.
Those guys are very believable in that whole story.
I agree.
You know, we don't.
And the book is compelling.
Yes, yes. So that is, you know, it's kind of tough to get involved in some of the abduction cases, but that is right up there, in my opinion, with Travis Walton and, you know, one of the most credible, and Betty and Barney Hill, one of the most credible type of abduction cases. Very, very fascinating. And, you know, one of the things that I didn't cover in the interview, and you can't really cover in a chapter in a book, is there's some ongoing things with these guys. I've talked to them personally.
Yeah.
You know, there's some strange ongoing things that keep happening to them all.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really amazing.
It's and like you, I think you put it perfectly. It's tough to capture it in a book or in an interview because it's so vast. You know, this has been a lifetime effect on these poor gentlemen, you know. And
really has.
And I completely agree that it's right up there with Travis Walton, you know, Whitley Strieber, Betty, Marnie Hill. I believe it's right up there.
Right, right. And so what, in your opinion, do you think that's one of the top cases in Maine, or what, you want to talk or about what some of your favorite cases were that you worked on?
Yeah, absolutely. That is, you know, right up there. That's probably the one that, you know, that I've known about, you know, the longest time, maybe the most famous one, if you will, you know, to almost to the point where it was, I was kind of obsessed with it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Great, compelling story. But I think some of the other great ones are the UFO over Starks. That was first written about in Yankee magazine. I believe that's the name of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very compelling story, especially once it gets involved with, you know, the sheriff over there and also the accident that occurred that same night in that same area. And the poor woman was wearing sunglasses, you know, in the middle of the night, you know, alluding to the fact that something very bright was out. And she actually wore prescription glasses, but, you know, felt the need to put on sunglasses in the middle of the night.
I know I read your entire book. I loved it. But that was quite some time ago, about 4 or 5 months ago. So why don't you, if you would, go over that case.
Absolutely. So this is a UFO that was reported over Starks back in 1981. And the whole incident started with a gentleman named Kinos Henry. And he was over Starks a few times. But this time was a little bit different. When he saw the UFO, at this point, it was red and it was pretty high in the sky. And then it got very, very low. And he swears to this day that it fired lasers down at the ground at him and his dog. I know it's a little tough to believe, but, you know, when it comes from Mainers, you know, it kind of makes you listen a little bit. You know, we're hardworking, honest people, you know.
Yeah. And very and really don't want to draw much attention. Usually.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, this encounter ended up lasting, you know, most of the night, where Kinos was scared and decided to hunker down with some friends. And he reported to them that there was a UFO outside firing lasers at him. And so, of course, that sounds crazy, and they didn't believe him. So they all go outside, and they do see, you know, a light in the sky. It's pretty high up, kind of star-sized. And so they were thinking that he was being a little, you know, a little ridiculous. But as they decided to get in their car and drive, you know, towards where they could see the light, it became lower and it became lower, and it kind of swooped at them. And while this is happening, there's a sheriff that's driving towards where the kids are. His name's Bud. And he lives in Madison, Maine. So this, you know, he's not from Starks, but he lives in Madison, and he was driving over towards Starks to get some dinner with his wife. And he came upon the kids who were staring at the light, and he stopped and talked to them. And they said, you know, there's a UFO over there. Don't go over there. You know, it's trying to attack us. And, you know, he thought they were being a little rambunctious, but he saw that they all seemed fairly serious, you know, and told them to be safe and get home for the night. So Bud and his wife continued on to Starks, and they themselves actually saw the UFO. And again, to them, it appeared star-sized at that time. And then it actually swooped in on them, and it got lower, and then it got right over a field right next to them. And, you know, Bud, being a sheriff, you know, not much really shakes him, but this made him nervous, and he ended up turning around and going a completely different way just to get to Starks. And then later that night, it was reported that a woman was driving on that same road in Starks, and she was in a car accident and died on the scene. And it was reported that, you know, some broken sunglasses were found on the ground near her car, and it had some blood on it. And from what I hear, she had some contusions close to her temple, which suggested that she was wearing sunglasses and also going at a high rate of speed. And there were no brake marks at all before she went off the road and into the woods, also suggesting that maybe it was very bright, and she could not see where the road turned and went off the road.
So this one could kind of lead you to the conclusion that she was trying to get the heck away from whatever it was as fast
right.
as she could.
Yep.
And it was really bright. I mean, there's no real evidence, but there's some evidence that would tend to make you believe that could be possible.
Sure. I mean, it's definitely circumstantial, but when you add all the pieces together, Kinos and what he and all of his friends saw, and then a sheriff and his wife, you know, who were interviewed by, you know, some New York papers about the incident, and then this poor woman who died that night as well. When you add them all together, it's a very compelling story.
Right, right. Now, do you know approximately what time of the evening did these line up in any type of way?
They lined up between Kinos and the sheriff. It lined up very consistently, but the woman was much, much later in the evening, I believe towards 11 to midnight. So it occurred much later.
Yeah. But again, who knows? And there was another case, or at least one other case, with police witness. I know people that are skeptic, you know, say, oh, you know, police are no better observers than anyone else. But the one thing that police have on their side is, you know, they're looking to protect, and they're someone who the public generally looks up to as far as upholding the law, and someone that you wouldn't expect to make things up so much.
Yeah. I completely agree. And one in particular that comes to mind, where it's not technically a police officer, but it's a formal naval intelligence technician. His name is Brad Luker, and he reported some very interesting lights in 2006 over Industry, Maine. And he is not one that believes in the paranormal. Even after what he saw, he just still can't believe that it would really be, you know, some sort of different intelligence, a different species from another planet. He still thinks that it may be military, but he has no idea what to make of it. But he saw these lights float right over him, probably, you know, 300 feet in the air, right over him, you know, the size of, you know, half a football field. And he had no idea what to make of it. And another woman or another person who was on the same road that night stopped where he was and also saw the lights. And but he stood there and stared at them. And he still, you know, he doesn't know what to make of them, but he just can't believe that it might be, you know, extraterrestrial.
You know, I had someone, I live in Maine, south of you, but I had someone contact me from the Portland area recently that told me there's all kinds of stuff happening in Maine all the time. And I said this a while back in a podcast. Richard Dolan was in Exeter, New Hampshire, and was asking, you know, for the show of hands. And there was about, I'd say about 200 people in the audience. It was pretty full. He asked them how many people saw what they believed was a possible UFO at some point in their life. And the show of hands were, let's just say, 100 people. And then when he asked how many people reported it, what they saw, there was only about 7 hands left. And so I think that's kind of across the board everywhere. And if you think there's, you know, approximately 30,000 sightings reported a year worldwide, if you do the math, that's a lot of people are seeing a lot of things. And the state of Maine is absolutely no exception to that. It's a big state.
Yeah, and I completely agree. And I'm glad you brought that point up. I talked with and worked with Peter Davenport from New Fork on some of the cases in this book, and he's a really great fellow to talk to. And we both expressed our concern over the amount of reports or the amount of sightings that go unreported. Like you were saying, you do the math, and, you know, out of 100 people that saw something, 7 report it. You know, it's too bad. And, you know, this field, you know, relies heavily on eyewitness, you know, testimony and, you know, move on. You know, it's just not something that people think to do when they see something that's strange, you know. And it would be very interesting to see the true account of how many things people are really seeing, you know.
Right. Well, you know, I think a lot of people don't know how to report it. I know that that was true. Certainly the case with myself. And, you know, years ago, it never occurred to me how to report something like that.
Sure.
And so quickly, can you just go through the chapters in the book and the different sightings for the listener out there?
Okay. So the book is actually broken up into some sections. There's abductions and Men in Black. And for abductions and Men in Black, we have the David Stevens case. We have the case from the doctor out of Old Orchard Beach, which I actually found some new information on recently that I'm going to send over to you.
You want to just throw that out there right now?
So Herbert Hopkins was a general practitioner out of Old Orchard Beach, and he had a Men in Black experience where he claimed, you know, a Man in Black came to his house. He was working on a David Stevens case, a gentleman out of Norway, and he was warned not to work on the case anymore. The gentleman who came to his house looked very odd, acted very odd, and threatened him to stop working on the case. Well, in 2008, his nephew, Herbert Hopkins' nephew, posted a blog about this story that has become folklore, you know, in Maine ufology, and even involved Shirley Fickett at one point, who was a noted Maine author or, you know, a noted Maine UFO researcher. And his nephew reports that as Herbert Hopkins got older, he was an alcoholic and liked to tell ridiculous stories and liked to write science fiction. And he is convinced that this is a work of fiction and that none of this occurred. And I'd like to send that information over to you at some point, Martin.
Sure, absolutely. And just quickly, if you can, for the rest of the book, for the listener out there.
Sure. There's great encounters. So, of course, we got the Starks encounter. There's a lawyer out of Soamesville, Maine, who owns a little tiny pond hopper plane. And he and a buddy were flying it, and they saw a UFO over the Blue Hill area. There was a UFO reported by some Boy Scouts back in the 50s, close to Millinocket. Franklin has had some lights reported over their town. North Whitfield has reported some sightings. Bangor has lots of sightings reported. One in particular back in the 60s, it's even reported that a gentleman fired his gun at the UFO. Mm. Very interesting story. There was an incident of a potential U.S. an unidentified submerged object out of Bucksport, Maine. And the reason it's being thought of as a USO is that these people reported that it appeared muddy and wet on the bottom of the craft and that there was actually kelp hanging off the bottom of it. So pretty interesting there. There's some compelling video of a UFO in Newport that I write about in the book. And one of the more interesting ones, I thought, was about crop circles being reported in Gardner. I actually went down there in 2010 and to check out the area. It was reported in 2004. I went down there in 2010. And I don't know if it's the power of suggestion, but the field that it was reported, you can still see some outlines of where the crop is not growing as well in that area. So that's definitely something you can check out. And then there's a very, very odd case of a woman out of Old Orchard Beach named Wendy C. Allen. She claims to this day be friends with an amphibian fairy that's an extraterrestrial that's probably 300 years old. And he communicates with her, and he sees her in the forest of Old Orchard Beach. And she says that he arrived on a UFO and that she communicates with aliens regularly. And that's just some of the stories that are in here.
Wow. That's kind of a bizarre one. Hey, well, thanks so much. Now, where can someone get your book? Amazon?
Yeah, you can get it on Amazon. You can go into Barnes & Noble. If you're local to Maine, you can go into any Bull Moose in Maine and pick up the book. You can pick up the book at any Barnes & Noble between Maine and New Hampshire. And for your listeners that are outside of New England, you can get it at barnesandnoble.com, bam.com, amazon.com, and anywhere books are sold.
Great. Well, thanks so much for being our guest today.
Martin, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
So that's it for today's show, and we will be back next week. A couple of people to thank: Keith Rowland, as always, for Dark Matter Radio Network, Andy Fleming for the clip, Nomar Slevic, of course, as our guest, Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. Remember, you can like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. I want to give Michael Lauk a great big thank you for helping out in my absence with his interview with Stanton Friedman. Really enjoyed that. We'll be back next week live with Alejandro Rojas and our guest unsure. So keep your eyes to the sky and your curiosity high.